Gracious Lord, again we thank you for the privilege of being here. I thank you for these people who love you so much and love each other so much that they desire to have the best marriages they can. And I know, Father, that none of us are experts about this, but we want the best that you have to offer us through our marriages. Help us to be attentive to you and help us to be attentive to the things you would have for us this day. And I pray, Father, too, that you would take the crumbs that are offered and that your Son would bless them and break them and distribute them in the power of your Holy Spirit, that each person would hear something that would benefit him or her this day. And we ask this in Christ's name. Amen. Peter and Laura came up to me after the last session and said, you never got to the three rooms, and I forgot I had put something on the three rooms in your deal. So it'd be interesting to see how creative any of you were on what you did on the three rooms. But real quick, I'll say something about it quickly. I don't have time to embellish it like I like to do. But I call the first room the Goodwill Hunting Room. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie. If you haven't, then one of your homework assignments is to go see it. The language is absolutely atrocious, but it's not gratuitous. These are rough and tumble guys in South Boston who talk like that. When you get Bad News Bears and 9-year-old girls are talking like that, that's gratuitous. They shouldn't be talking like that. Those boys shouldn't be talking like that too, but they might. Nevertheless, the story, you've got Will Hunting played by Matt Damon. And he has a friend, Ben Affleck. These guys wrote that screenplay in their 20s. And you go, how did they have this kind of insight to do this thing? Anyway, so the Matt Damon character, he has been raised in the foster system. He's been horribly abused throughout his life. He's got gazillions of scratches on his record. But he's Einstein-level genius. And he's got this good friendship with Ben Affleck's character and so on. So he's got somebody in life that helps him have a rudder to make his way, but he's in a lot of trouble. He's got a record, you know, and he defends himself in court. He reads about stuff. He's got photographic memory and so on. He's working as a custodian at MIT, and there's this hotshot professor who won the Fields Medal, which is even better than the Nobel Prize. And he puts a problem up on the backboard and he says, if any of you people could figure this out, I can get you a 6-figure income right out of graduation, right after graduation, but none of you will figure it out because it's way over your heads. Next day they come and the thing's figured out and they go, who did this? And he calls the students and none of them will own it because they know if they say that they did it, he'll give them another problem. They won't be able to figure it out. So he puts another problem on the board and he says, this one took me 2 years. Me, the Fields winner, the guy's arrogant as all get out. Fields winner to figure out, none of you will be able to figure this one out. They come back the next day, it's figured out. He realizes he's in the presence of Einstein-level genius. And so he puts a problem on the board the next day, and that night he's working late and he comes out of a meeting with his TA and they see the custodian. And they go to the thing, they go, where are you going? What are you? And he goes running off. And they go to the blackboard and he's figured it out. He sees it. He goes, who is this guy? So he goes the next day to the custodian's office to get him, but this guy's gotten in trouble for a probation violation and he's in jail. And he is able to talk the courts into letting him go under his supervision because he wants to use him. And the Will Hunting character knows what it's like to be used. So the professor is told, you've got to get him in psychological care, though. So he takes him to all these hotshot psychologists. He knows, you know, these MIT, Harvard guys and so on. He reads their books. Will Hunting reads their books the night before, and he ties them all in knots. He's got one last hope. His old college roommate, Robin Williams. The only Academy Award Robin Williams ever won was for this movie. He takes him to Robin Williams, who was a Harvard grad in psychology, teaching psychology at a community college. And this professor thinks he's wasted his life, pouring his life into kids back at the community college in the old neighborhood. But Robin Williams doesn't feel that way. He's pouring his life into people who matter. And this guy doesn't, the professor doesn't have any sense of that. He's a user, not a nurturer. As a matter of fact, when he first walks into the class, the professor comes to see Robin Williams to see if Robin Williams will do what these other guys won't do. And he just breaks into the classroom. And the first thing you hear Robin Williams saying is that you have to be able to hear the person. And you gain trust with the person. That's what he's saying as he's finishing up the class. Professor breaks in because he's more important than the class. And he asks him if he'll meet with Will Hunting. Will Hunting goes to his office, and the professor sits down. And here's Robin Williams going to talk to Will Hunting, and the professor sits down like he's going to be a part of it. Come on, let's get the healing going here. And Robin Williams says, "You're out of here." And the Will Hunting guy catches up Robin Williams in an issue, kind of making fun of some painting he drew and making fun of his relationship. He doesn't know that Robin Williams' wife has died of cancer. And so Robin Williams has Will Hunting by the neck, and Will Hunting goes, "Counseling session is over." And Robin Williams says to the professor, "Have him back next week, I'll see him." He comes back the next week, and they go to a little bench at Boston Gardens where the swan boats are going by and ducks lazily swimming by. The professor says, "I thought about you a lot this last week, and I thought about you last week late into the night, and then I haven't thought about you much since then. But," he said, I want to know you, but I think all your knowledge is book knowledge. I don't think you've really leaned into real life. You know about war because you've read all kinds of books on war, but you've never sat cradling your best friend's head," because Robin Williams' character was a Vietnam vet, "cradling your best friend's head while he's bleeding to death from battlefield wounds. You've read about love, but you don't know what it's like to sit by the bedside of the woman you love. And even though all the signs say visiting hours are over, everybody knows you're not leaving her bedside. You know about this, you know about that." He says, "You're an orphan, aren't you?" And Matt Damon kind of hangs his head and says, "Yeah." He said, "What would you think if I said, I know all about it, I read Oliver Twist once?" He says, "I want to know you, and there's no way I can know you just from a book." And so the next week, he comes back. And Matt Damon sits there and doesn't say a word the whole time. Professor comes to collect him and says, "Did you fix him?" Because he wants to use him. And Robin Williams says, "He didn't say a thing the whole time." Professor says, "Is that good?" Robin Williams' character says, "Pretty impressive, actually." "Why? Why was it impressive?" "Because that kid wants to know, if I don't give you what you want, are you going to hang with me, or are you going to bail?" And so it ends up, after a couple counseling sessions, they start a relationship. And the whole movie is basically built and fleshed around the skeletal structure of these counseling sessions. He's got relationship attachment disorder. There's a mini driver, love interest. There's a bunch of stories going on. There's five different stories going on, but this is the central story. And finally, it comes to a place where real trust is developed. And Robin Williams comes, and he puts all these pictures on this table of abuse. Places where Matt Damon's characters had cigarette butts put out in him, knife wounds, bruises from beatings and stuff like that. Matt Damon's character says to Robin Williams, "Do you know about this?" Robin Williams says, "Yeah." He says, no. "Do you know about this? Is this something you've seen in my file? Or is this something you know about?" Matt Damon says, "Yeah, actually, it's something I do know about." You realize out of his own woundedness, he's learned to work with other people. And they talk about it a little bit. And then what does Robin Williams say to Matt Damon at that moment that is the key point of that whole movie? Say it real loud. "It's not your fault." And Robin Williams doesn't, I mean, Matt Damon doesn't get it. He laughs, I know. No, that's a deflection. And Robin Williams says it again, it's not your fault. Yep, I know. We're square, I know. It's not your fault. I know. It's not your fault. Stop messing with me, man. And he bursts into tears and falls in Robin Williams' arms. And all of a sudden, the soul cyst has been lanced. The pus is coming out. And there's a healing moment in that movie. It wasn't your fault. And what do you get to learn at that moment? The scratches in your record were not your fault. This is the word you grew up in. Did God abandon you in those moments? No. Not only does creation imply intention, even you being nurtured in a broken, fallen world implies intention. God has purposes. Joseph says to his brothers, you meant evil against me. God meant it for good. First room, the Robin Williams room, the Goodwill Hunting room. It's not your fault. What's the next room? It's a dark room, a very dark room. You have to look at what is your fault. I know people who've gotten to the place where it's not your fault in therapy and so on. And they think, well, that's good. That's all I needed. So now they go around hurting people right and left and say, it's not my fault. No, pain not transformed is transferred. If you have pain, there's something you inherited, wasn't your fault, but inadvertently you were nurtured in that environment and it was normalized for you at some level. And you pass it on. And that second room is dark. And all of a sudden you've got to grieve what happened and you've got to go back and set right so you could break the cycles of generational sin. Sin not transformed is transferred, but also the sins of the parents are visited on the children of the third and fourth generation. You go back and ask forgiveness of the people you might have hurt. Ask forgiveness of your spouse. While you're asking forgiveness, something crazy begins to happen in your mind. Good crazy. You say to yourself, if you only knew, I was doing the best I knew how. You don't say that to the person you're asking forgiveness of because it muddies the water of your asking forgiveness. But in your own mind, as you say, if you only knew I was doing the best I knew how, what does that tell you? The people who hurt you were probably also doing the best they knew how. And it accelerates your forgiveness backwards. And it accelerates helping you to break free of that sorrow. And it also accelerates the fact that you realize those people who hurt you had been hurt before and it breaks your heart for them. There's something tender about that. And that's the doorway into the third room. What's the third room? The wounded healer room. It's where you get to go be more like Jesus in relationship with other people. And it's tender. It's a tender room. And it begins by you being a wounded healer to the people who hurt you first. Anyway, those are the three rooms. We could go into more detail on it, but does that help a little? Yeah. Okay, so anyway, now we're talking about communication and sex, but communication first. In the King James Version, it says, Adam knew his wife and she conceived. It's a whole process of knowing. And it's a knowing that requires good communication. And we don't have time to talk about all the ways you could do communication. I believe as couples, you should read a book a year on marriage. I don't think you should read the same book. Because the temptation will be if you're reading the same book, you'll be reading it for your spouse. Well, when's she going to get around to page 27? When's he going to start doing page 113? You know, don't read the same book. You could read a book together on marriage, read it out loud and so on and talk about it. Better yet, read it in a group of couples. Or maybe once a month you meet together and talk about a book you're reading as a couple, as couples. And get through a book, go slow, get through it in a year. But anyway, you should read a book a year on marriage. And there's maybe the big topics are communication. There's issues on psychological intimacy. There's issues on historical and intellectual, spiritual intimacy, and so on it goes. Communication and whatnot, raising children, finances and marriage, and so on. There's probably about 8 or 10 big topics. So every 10 years, you start another book on that topic. After 20 years of marriage, you've got on the job 40 years combined experience, and you've got 20 books you've read together, or 40 books if you're reading different books. And it's like the equivalent of a master's degree in marriage. There are people who have been married for years, and they really don't know much about it because they haven't really, they've moved in the house, but they didn't do the necessary work. They got the garden, but they weren't doing the necessary tending of the garden. Talk about sexual intimacy. You read the Song of Solomon, and the woman says to the bridegroom, this is your garden. He starts tending the garden. She says, come into your garden. It's a very sensuous passage. But she's inviting him to come into her at the place where he is assuming responsibility for the garden. So anyway, you're reading these books. That'll help you grow and so on. But you see that there's communication issue. And I always like to say, start off by communicating honestly. And we don't always communicate honestly. I remember catching myself, it was about year 5 of my marriage, I would say things like this to Claudia, you always, you never, I'm sure none of you have ever done that, but anyway, when you make the statement you always, you never, it's fundamentally false. I mean, Claudia would sleep, she would work, she was a great wife and mother. And she would engage in all the activities that relate to that. So I'm upset about something and I say, you always, you never. That's not accurate. What do people respond to when you say something is inaccurate? They don't respond to the point you want to make. They respond to all of this. So she does something, little thing. And I want to be heard. So what do? I make an atom bomb out of it. I just make it big as life. She's done this and I say all this. And what does she respond to? Not that. She says, well, I don't do that, and I don't do this. I don't know what you're talking about over here. We talk like this. And again, I'm sure none of you have ever done that. But nevertheless, I realized I was doing poorly. And it came to my confession time at the end of the day. I hope you all do that. And I say, Lord, I overstated. I was not fair to my wife. I'm so sorry. And I go ask her forgiveness. And something would come up. And I would do the always, you never. And I'd say, Lord, help me get past this. I want to do better. And this happened for about 5 months. We'd have an argument maybe once a month, and it would be the you always, you never thing. And finally, there came the day when God, in his grace, answered my prayer in the midst of my, inflation. I say, Claudia, you always do this. And I stopped, and I said, no, out loud. That's not true. She looks at me. And then I said, but a lot of times you do that. And I go, no, that's not true either. Sometimes you, and I go, no, that's not true. Claudia, this is so infrequent. What's the matter with me that this bothers me so much? Now we're getting someplace. Maybe what bothers me is something that's from the scratch of my record. It could be, too, that when I say, what's the matter with me that this bothers me so much, I am being taken right to the passage where Jesus says, if you see your neighbor has a speck in his or her eye, you may need to do some speck extraction. But what are you supposed to do first? Log extraction. Remove the log from your own eye. Two things happen when you do. First, you see better. Second, your own eye is still hurting from its own recent surgery, that you're more tender if you have to tend to the speck in somebody else's eye. Be honest in your communication. And in that honesty, we begin to consider the places in our life that are obstacles to our developing and growing in our communication. Second, there are these informal fallacies, and you were given the list, I think, when you came in. I just want to say a few words about them. Our culture is fraught with this informal fallacy stuff. How many of you have studied these things in logic in college and stuff, introduction to philosophy? When I would teach a class at Wheaton the last probably 15 years, I don't know if I did it when you guys were in class, I would give these out to the students, and I'd say, I want you to learn these. I want you to learn them, and I want you to observe them. When you're in late night talks in the dorm, if you see them, smell them out. If you watch the news, I don't care if you watch right or left news, it's both sides are fraught with this stuff, freighted with it. If you go to your lectures, observe them, because it happens. If you see it in me, come confront me. If you see it in your other profs, don't confront them. Don't be obnoxious. But even when you hear sermons, watch for them. They occur. And if I see them in your paper, I will grade you down. Oh, passing them out? You're passing them out right now? There you go. It was fun to see the confusion on their faces, though. It took away my joy, my happiness, my humor. Okay, so I would give these out to them. I say, if I see them in your paper, you'll be knocked down a grade if this is in your paper. It's a little more philosophical and so on, but I'm giving them to you because if you can learn to spot them and remove them from your marriage, you remove this kind of communication. Not all of it. We'll talk more about it later. But you, the person will respond to the falsehood that you've uttered rather than the point that you want to make. It's better to communicate honestly so that you can communicate about real issues, not about false issues. So I'm just going to look at a few of them, and you can read them yourself and learn them. And start practicing. Keep them by your television if you're watching nightly news. And anytime you see one, say, oh, there's one of those things. Oh, there's one of those things. So you learn how to spot them quickly and learn how to excise them from your own practice. And again, I don't think you should go everywhere. And when you hear one, you know you're at the grocery store and somebody says something at the checkout and you decide you're going to pontificate about how you guys are involved in informal fallacies. Shame on you, you know, that sort of thing. You become obnoxious. And the first one's a sweeping generalization. You know, all elephants walk in a single file line, at least the one I saw did. It lacks nuance. It's inaccurate. It's not fair. The hasty generalization, too few instances to properly support the generalization. Can I say Prague is the most beautiful city in the world? I can say it. Does it have any merit? No. Why? I haven't been to every city in the world. Can I say Prague's the most beautiful city I've ever seen? Yeah, but you can ask me what? What cities have I seen? If I say to you, well, I've seen Barstow, California, it's not going to have much credit. I just was through Barstow and I bought a t-shirt in Barstow, California. I was going to try and pop it out while I was saying this, but nevertheless, if I say to you, I've been to Salzburg, I've been to Quebec City, I've been to Seattle, San Francisco, I've been to Prague, I've been to Budapest, I've been to, and I could go on and on and on talking about all these places, Zermatt, where the Matterhorn is, all that stuff, Cape Town, South Africa. I could say all these places, and now if I say Prague's the most beautiful city I've seen, it has a little more punch. But what's still lacking? How do you define beauty, and how do you apply that to a city? And if I can't give you that, then I'm reduced to just saying, yeah, I really like Prague. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's not inflated. It's honest. So anyway, there's the hasty generalization. The abusive ad hominem. Call the person a name. You voted for Trump. Why, you must be a narcissist. You voted for Biden, you must be a Marxist. And there we go. We just start calling people names. No, tell me what the problem is, and let's talk about it definitionally, and let's get down to substance rather than being dismissive. I think that this is really important. This is one that's invasive in our culture. I can't call a person a narcissist. I haven't had them on my couch. I'm not a psychologist. I don't even have the wherewithal to make that judgment. I think I could say I think a person's leaning towards Marxism because I read the Communist Manifesto every 3 years just to see where our culture is going. But nevertheless, I think that we make these judgments in the sweeping generalizations and we don't know that much about them. Straw man arguments, you misrepresent the opponent's point of view. And then start to dismantle your misrepresentation. It's not fair to that person. That's projection. Hypothesis contrary to fact. Had the Wright brothers not invented a flying heavier than air flying machine? My wife says my mind's like lightning, one flash, then total darkness. If the Wright brothers hadn't invented a heavier than air machine, airplanes would have never been invented. You don't know that. That's a misjudgment. And so this is hypothesis contrary to fact. False analogy, you compare apples and oranges. You guys know what those are. Begging the question, that's when you assume the outcome, but you haven't proved the point. Another one is poisoning the wells. You attack the person's character in a way that seeks to prejudice others from that person before they've had a chance to state their case. Before my opponent speaks, I want you to know he beats up old ladies in nursing homes and has not paid taxes in years. He stole the Girl Scout cookie drive revenues, and he lets his dog poop on his neighbor's yard and never cleans it up. You say that about the guy before he gets up, and now, you know, where is he at? These are falsehoods, but he's now got to spend his whole time fixing these things. It's terrible, terrible, terrible. You got suppressed evidence. Fallacy of the complex question expects a yes or no answer to a question that's more complex than that. It fails to nuance. The red herring, you see this all the time. They ask the person the question, and what do? They answer something over here. It's called a red herring because the fish has just swum over here, and you never got the answer to the question here. Sentimental appeal. This is one that's killing our country, I think. You have the person who appeals to the sad story. So here's a moral point. Maybe it's a text of scripture where God has commanded us in his wisdom to move in this direction. And a person will say, yeah, but I have a son, or I have a daughter, or I have a friend. And so consequently, they cave on the moral revealed objective truth because of their concern for their friend. How do you answer that? And what we do is we have whole cultures that are caving. You see churches that have rainbow flags on them. I think we need to say anybody should be welcome to our church. But we shouldn't, in the saying anybody's welcome, capitulate by saying anybody's behavior is also welcome in the church. These behaviors are not appropriate. If they come to church, great. Can they be a member? No. Because they're not willing to come under spiritual discipline, but they should be able to come to church. Paul says, if you want to get rid of all this stuff, you got to go out of the world. But in the church, these things shouldn't be. And it's tragic because we've got the church that's caved on sentimental appeal. And when I meet somebody like this, you know what I tell them? I want to praise you that you have love and compassion for people who are struggling. That's got merit. But I want to caution you, you also need to maintain the truth. You need to start answering these things the way Jesus answered them. They said, where did Jesus ever address these things? The woman caught in the well. I mean, the woman caught in adultery. In John 8, they throw her down. Where's the man? That's my first question. You know, they're just trying to trip Jesus up, but where's the man? And then what do they say to him? They say, she committed adultery. Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. What do you say? They're bringing truth. They don't have any love. And what does Jesus say? Let him who's without sin cast the first stone. Moses also said that. But they leave that out conveniently. And they start to peel off. And he's left alone with the woman. And what does he say to her? Did no one condemn you? No one, Lord. Neither do I condemn you. There's the love. But what else does he say? Go your way and sin no more. There's the unwillingness to compromise the truth. And you've got Ephesians 5, when it tells us to be filled with the Spirit, it talks about the fact that we should walk in love, and it's followed with all the abuses of love, immorality, all this other stuff. So then it says in verse 8 of that chapter, walk in light, that's the truth. And then if you have people who walk in truth without love, they become harsh, censorious, judgmental. How are we going to do this? Ephesians 5:15, be careful how you walk. The Greek word for careful, akribos, from which we get the word acrobat. It takes dexterity. It's complex. Ephesians 5:18, be filled with the Spirit. You're not going to do it on your own. You need to be filled with the Spirit. So in our communication, these things come up. There's some other ones, a non sequitur. It doesn't have the sequence and the inferences to what we're saying. There's gaps in it. We haven't reasoned our way through this very well. Probably if we haven't, we can engage in the conversation interrogatively. We're trying to figure it out rather than judgmentally. But we could begin to say, well, you know, I've got it figured out to this far. I've really thought it through. But I have a little bit of gap from here to here. I wonder if we can maybe talk about that and move on to greater clarity. Richard Weaver, who wrote have any of you ever heard of the book Ideas Have Consequences? He was a rhetorician at the University of Chicago. He wrote a sequel to it called The Ethics of Rhetoric. In The Ethics of Rhetoric, he says there are four kinds of ethical arguments. First one, the argument from definition. That's the most ethical, because a definition is something. It's objective. We've got a definition. But you can't always define things. Definition means of the finite. To define a thing, it has to be small enough that you could wrap words around it and distinguish it, the podium from the microphone from the guitar. How then do you define God if he's infinite? So the second form of ethical argument is the argument from similitude. And the argument from similitude is like Jesus speaking of the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven is like. He's a simile, metaphor, figures of speech. It's when I can't get to a definition, but it still has some substance. The least ethical form of argument is the argument from consequence. If you vote for my opponent in this next election, the whole world's going to go to hell in the handbasket. How do I know that? There's no reality that supports the claim. It's basically something that's imagined and something that is cultivated to create fear in the audience so that you'll vote for me in the next election. I try to win you coercively. It's very unethical and it's very manipulative. The fourth form, he doesn't give an ethical valuation, and it's the argument from authority. When I don't know how to argue the point, but I quote somebody else or I produce books like the quotable C.S. Lewis or something like that. You know, that's a book I did, so nevertheless. Okay, so anyway, just to keep that in mind, you want to get some good stuff? David Brooks, you guys know him, the New York Times columnist? He's got that new book out, How to Know a Person. That is a great book, and it's good on communication, listening to one another, and talking through these various sorts of things. Okay, the next one is you want to minimize ambiguity. Ambiguity breeds anxiety. Minimize them to the best you can. And the way you minimize ambiguity, define terms. And then communicate expectations fairly. If you were hurt by your spouse, you don't say, "You hurt me." You're assuming when you say, "You hurt me," that your spouse set up that time to hurt you. You don't know that. But what you should say instead of accusing is maybe give the consequence of their action. You could say, "You know, when this happened, I felt sad. I felt sad." And now your spouse hears what? "Wow, it was sad." And then you can say to them useful information. "In the future, I would like it if you would do such and such." And you're giving useful information without giving an accusation. You can say what the consequences were. You were hurt, or you felt frustrated, or you felt like what you had to say was maybe not taken into account, something like that. But you're being careful about not accusing, giving the consequences of what the action was, and then telling them what you'd like in the future. This removes accusation or impute intention. I've given up, like I said, I think earlier, I've given up trying to assess my spouse's intentions because my own motives so often are a mystery to me. How can I be so cocksure I understand another person's motives? Another one's the Johari window. And the Johari window, how many of you know the Johari window in communication theory? Okay, Johari window, it's not from India or Pakistan. Two communication theorists, one was named Joseph and one was named Harry, and they combined their thinking. And the Johari window has four panes. The first pane, what I know about myself and others know about me. I'm bald, kind of portly. People tell me they want what they want for Christmas often, you know, they come up and tell me. My students, my former students, my friends, they know what? They know I'm an extrovert. They know I love to be around people. And so on. That's what I know and others know about me. Second pane, what I don't know about myself and others do. You know, none of you have ever had a direct experience with your own face. You've seen it reflected in a mirror, maybe in water, but you've never even seen your own face before. So if I blow my nose before I leave the house in the morning and I don't see that there's a booger there, and I go out and everybody's giving me these funny looks and I don't know what's going on. Unless somebody tells me you got a booger in your nose, Jerry, I may not see it until I go to wash my hands midday before I eat lunch. And I go, oh my word, how long's that been there? If your zipper's down, you don't know till somebody tells you, whatever the case might be. How many of you want to hear if you got a booger in your nose rather than walk through the rest of the day with that? How many of you want to hear about a soul booger that you have that other people see and you don't see? We have to open ourselves up to hearing in the area of the second pane of our Johari window. And it's not easy, but I want to hear them because I don't want to live like that all my life. Third pane. What I know about myself and others don't know. I mentioned to you about my brother and brother-in-law and trying to put together their funerals and realizing their lives were way more complex than I knew, and I knew them well. But none of us knows another person well unless they reveal. And so that third pain is our willingness to tell another person about what's going on in our life. The greatest confidant you should have in your life is sitting next to you in this meeting, your spouse. And learn to cultivate sharing your heart. And if you hear the heart of your spouse, learn to hear well. Because if you don't hear well, you'll shut down your spouse from wanting to communicate with you. So that's your gift to your spouse. Listen well. Don't judge. Listen. Fourth pain. What I don't know about myself and nobody else knows either. Circumstance squeezes it out of us. My father was in 3D-day invasions in the South Pacific. I told you about that before. What if you're on a landing craft going in at Tarawa, the bloodiest battle of World War II? My dad was in the first wave. And you're hearing the bullets ping on the side of that landing craft. Pretty soon you're going to hit sand. The front end's going to open up. What do you do? Are you going to get in the fetal position in that place and cry for your mother? Or are you going to run out in the hail of bullets? We could talk till we're blue in the face about what we would do. But we don't know till circumstance squeezes it out of us. Now, we can practice certain things that might give us an inclination of what we might do. Something like 80% of the people decorated in World War II were varsity athletes in college or high school. You can know that if you're practicing something, it's more likely that this will come out, but you can't be sure. So anyway, that's the fourth pain. So the Johari window is a good communication thing for us to keep in mind. And then Basil Mitchell. He was a philosopher at University of Chicago. You had to read his book, didn't you? Did you guys have to read Faith and Criticism? Or maybe you were supposed to and didn't? Sarah remembers. So Basil Mitchell was my doctoral supervisor. He was at Oxford University at Oriel College. He wrote this book called Faith and Criticism. He says many good things about understanding other people. But one of them, he says, you cannot be neutral. And you shouldn't shame yourself that you're not neutral. Your life has been informed by your life's experiences, by your personality, by all kinds of things that shape the person you bring to any situation. Don't be ashamed of that. But realize the lack of neutrality can also affect your ability to hear and communicate with another person. So he says, don't make neutrality the goal, make impartiality the goal. So how can you become impartial? And Mitchell says, by giving the other person veto power over your impression of their point of view. So if Claudia says this to me, my wife is Claudia, if she says this to me, and through my grid, which is not impartial, but and it's not neutral, I hear this. We end up talking like this. And I failed to ask her for definition. I failed to ask for clarification and so on. So we talk like this. 3 days later, I say to her, hey, Claudia, do you remember the other day when you said this to me? She said, I never said that to you. I say, Claudia, I was in the room. Now it's a matter of integrity. No, I didn't hear her. Mitchell says you give the other person veto power over your impression of their point of view. You give the other person veto power over your impression of their point of view. She says this to me, I hear this. And I say, Claudia, is this what you meant? Heavens no, where did you get that? I say, well, I don't always get it right in this marriage. She says, yeah, you've demonstrated that frequently enough. I say, give it to me again. She gives it to me again. I say it back to her. I say, is this it? She says, that's better, but that's still not quite it. Please be patient with me. Give it to me again. She gives it to me again. And she says, that's it. That's where I'm at. You know what? Probably 80% of the time, that ends the conflict. I go, wow, that makes a lot of sense given X, Y, and Z. Or I might say to her, that makes a lot of sense given X, Y, and Z, but were you aware of A, B, and C? And she might say, no. That's useful information then for the conversation to go further. Might be she says, yeah, I was aware of X, Y, and Z. Were you aware of L, M, N, O, and P? But at least we're on the same page, and we can begin to have a good discussion that helps move us forward in that understanding. And then there's so many things we could talk about communication, but I'll just let it go there, okay? Unless in the Q&A, maybe we can bring up more. But I want to talk for a minute about sexual intercourse. So we could talk about intercourse as communication, but now sexual intercourse. Why are men and women, there are generally some exceptions, but when it comes to sexual desire, why are men and women wired so differently? Do you ever ask yourself that question? Men seem to be hot to trot any given second, you know. Women maybe not so quickly. Some women are. I've been around, I did postmarital counseling, premarital counseling as a pastor for years. I've seen everything, it seems like. I haven't seen everything, that's overstated. That's Prague's most beautiful city in the world. But I've seen a lot. But generally speaking, we're not wired the same way. And why is that? Why did God make us so different? Not only anatomically different, but different as far as sexual drive and impulse. And I think the reason why is because sex is an audiovisual picture of what should be going on in our marriages all the time. The high courtesy of heaven. I offer my life for you. The problem is with sex in our culture is it's pretty much depicted male-centered. And who gets left out then? Women. So I don't know if you guys, we did this when you guys did your, did you, we do your premarital counseling one-on-one or were you with a group? There's a small group. So I'd say to women, sometimes I'd do these things at Wheaton College. We'd have a group of women. So Peter Walters, Mark Lewis, and I went, and all these women at Williston wanted to have a conversation with the three profs about sex and men and all this other stuff. So we go there to the thing. I go, how many of you heard the first time you have sex, it's going to hurt? 100% of the women raise their hand. 100%. That's what they had heard from their girlfriends who got married and hadn't had sex. They had walked a pure life. They come back after they get married and they said, man, it really hurt. And I say to them, it never has to hurt. Why does it hurt? Because we're not talking about these things well. The older birds aren't teaching the younger birds how to fly. Here's why it hurts. Here's this poor guy. He's been looking forward to sex. And finally, he's met this woman. He's fallen in love with her. He knows the day is coming. They're going to make love together. The wedding is over. The party's over. They get to the room, finally, on the honeymoon. He's so excited that he premature ejaculates. He wants to be in his wife. So just before it happens, he pushes. She's not ready for him. And that's why it happens. And then he says, wow, I thought it was going to be more exciting than this. But he's done, so he rolls over and goes to sleep, and she's saying, I don't know what's going on here. And that happened so early on in so many marriages. I don't know if it happened in yours or not. But here's the woman then who thinks, well, I got to figure it out. You start figuring it out pretty quick after that first experience. But the problem is, it's male-centered. Did you know that men can have orgasm one way? Women can have orgasm up to 12 ways. My wife and I have figured out 8 of them. And I think to myself, what a ripoff. The man, the nerve endings at the end of a man's penis is 1/10 the amount of nerve endings in a woman's clitoris or clitoris. And I go, what a ripoff. And here's a woman all of a sudden getting excited, and the man's asleep. He got what he wanted, and he thinks it's over. And I would tell couples when I would say, you know what? If you have premature ejaculation, don't worry about it. Put that aside, and now get on to some serious lovemaking. Because now you have time to spend time pleasuring your wife. Bring your wife into the experience. And if you bring her into the experience and pleasure her, and she has orgasm, she's eager for you to come into her. And all of a sudden, that will be better for you. The man, it's always going to be good for him. But for the woman to have this kind of experience in lovemaking, you need to learn the art of loving and the art of pleasuring your wife. So what do you do? You can go read books. I don't know about you guys. I was reading all kinds of books before I got married because I was utterly clueless. All the Christian books were about the most ambiguous things I had ever seen in my life. They didn't give me a lick of help. And I wasn't going to read the non-Christian stuff because it was raunchy. So I found this guy named Ed Wheat. He was a medical doctor. And he was very explicit and very helpful and very clear. But how many of you remember when you'd go to the doctor's office and they'd take your temperature with a thermometer and they'd pull it out of sitting in alcohol or something? I don't know what kind of stuff it was. And they'd put it in your mouth. And remember how antiseptic that thing tasted? Well, Ed Wheat's instruction on sex was kind of like that. It was clear, but it was antiseptic and medicinal, and it didn't sound so great. But still, the tapes were helpful, and I would loan them to students, and they wouldn't bring them back. They were embarrassed to go buy a set themselves, so it was easier to steal their prof's tapes. And I got to the place where I couldn't get them anymore. I'd get them used or something like that. So finally, I decided I got to get some new data to give to students when I do premarital counseling, and we finally get to the sexual stuff. So I went and read reviews, and I read reviews about different material. Some were Christian, some were not Christian, and I ordered them. I got 10 things. I ordered 10 books. One of them that came was just straight pornography. So I wrapped it up in brown paper bags. I put rubber bands around it, put more brown paper bags around that, put plastic bags around that, and drove it far from the campus to throw it away because the missionary kids would always go to dumpsters behind the drug stores because they were trying to look for food, so they did dumpster diving, they called it. I didn't want one of them to find this book in the dumpster, so I got rid of the thing. What I found was many of the Christian books were ambiguous. The secular books were raunchy. You know, when you're doing it, sounded like a bunch of dogs. But I found one person who was helpful, and I'm going to give you her name, and I don't fully endorse her. And I'll tell you why I don't fully endorse her. But first, let me tell you how she got her information. She did it by case studies. She did it by bringing in couples and talking about what they've learned as far as their own sexual practices. And she gathered this information and made it available to people. I thought that was a good way for her to do her research. I can't fully endorse her because there's a couple of things I disagree with that she says. But by and large, I thought she was the best one out there. Her name was Lou Paget, P-A-G-E-T, Lou Paget. Her early stuff is good. Her later stuff is not. And the reason why her later stuff is not is because she's trying to teach people how to understand pleasure with their bodies. And because we've moved into a realm where there's so much gay sex and so on, she tries to give instruction that way too in her later material. Her early stuff, she doesn't. The book that I would recommend is The Big O, Orgasms, How to Give Them and How to Keep Them Coming. And I would use it with couples. I have one friend who, all of his kids, when they got married, he gave them that book. And they got married. You can take it with you on your honeymoon, or you could do it even in your second honeymoon now that you're married and so on. It's all line drawings. There's nothing that's pornographic about it. The instructions are clear and so on. And you can try this stuff and have a great time having pleasure. I tell men, pleasure your wife first. I never make love to my wife unless I've given her orgasm at least 5 times. It's just my goal. My goal. And it's amazing how fast you could give your wife orgasm 5 times. So this is the thing. Lou Paget, her website is called Frankly Speaking. I don't give it a full endorsement any more than I give a full endorsement to the ambiguous Christian material. Probably the best Christian material I saw out there was probably the guy who wrote the Left Behind series. Tim LaHaye. Tim and Beverly LaHaye have some pretty good stuff in their book. I don't think it's as good as Lou Paget, but there you go. And what can I say more about this? A couple things about Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon is extremely explicit We don't translate all the stuff. So, you know, when it says the taste of honey is under her tongue, what kind of kissing are they doing there? It's clearly French kissing. How many of you have read the passage that says her navel is like a goblet full of wine? It's not navel. The Hebrew word is shore. Shore is a vulva. He's giving her oral sex in Song of Solomon. It's there. We don't translate it. But he's pleasuring his wife. And so here it is right there in Song of Solomon and whatnot. Anyway, seek to pleasure the other person. Sex is an audiovisual picture of the high courtesy of heaven. You are different than me. I offer my life in seeking to serve you. And I think if we start thinking about wives first, women first, we can maybe set right some of the stuff that's messed up in our culture that says men only, or men what? They end up using people. They take advantage of other people. They hurt other people because they're not thinking beyond their own self-interest. And that's destructive to a relationship.